a big hit. Did you already just talk about that when you had your show?
No,
your
no,
new
I didn't,
show.
But it was...
So we're told by the what's wrong? Turn that off, like Ear Buddies DJ. What, you can just take it out, right?
Yeah. Which one is it? This one?
Yeah. You said this was more popular
early
in the 50s or something. Well, or they had another version that was even dirtier in the 50s.
That was a cover, Chuck Berry cover, 1972, I think.
Uh-huh.
Of a blues song from the 50s.
Yeah.
Which was even dirtier.
All right. I'm glad to hear the 50s wasn't total, you know, jingoism and patriarchy.
Had to start somewhere,
so
right?
All right. Take care.
See you.
And you're listening to WMFO, that's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. We're a little slice of that community-based. We're socialist alternative radio. We'll be here live for the next 2 hours, and we're here every other Sunday. And we're talking music from a working-class, democratic socialist perspective. And this week, we're lucky to have Diego back in the studio, special guest Diego, back from his travels.
Oh, yeah.
Which hopefully we can talk about a little bit. Also, we have a lot to talk about, the Chicago teacher strike. There's also the big GM strike we talked about 2 weeks ago, still happening. UAW, United Auto Workers, workers on strike, and others on strike in support of them, and others being affected by that strike still. We'll talk a little bit about, you know, our democracy, as they say, and the corporate media, and how that's being bought and paid for in various ways by big business, by the corporate elite, and some other stuff, if we have time, on inequality and the climate crisis, global warming, you know, all that. I was reading an article, just to digress for a second. Reading an article in The Nation about the last salmon fishery, the best last salmon fishery, not the last one technically, but the sort of most wild in off the coast of Alaska. And the EPA has cleared, obviously part of the Trump regime, but you know, that stuff like this happened under Democratic Party regimes as well, obviously, that they could build a mine near the mouth of the river, because salmon go from the ocean to river back, you know, that sort of thing, and that will mess things up. But just by global warming, they're finding that a lot of salmon in around the world, I guess, but in Alaska especially, they can't handle the heat, basically, the warmed up ocean, and especially the warmed up streams, and so there was like massive die-offs of salmon, you know. So anyway, I'm just saying that, like, just making a point that hopefully is a bit of a cliche to our listeners, but maybe someone new is listening in, and hopefully a cliche to a lot of people. But this, you know, the global warming climate disaster scenario is really extremely real and happening right before our eyes. And people that work close to nature are experiencing it directly and understanding something is off, something is really wrong. I get it myself, not because I'm a farmer. But I grew up, most of the time I grew up, when I was growing up, most of my growing up, if you want to call it that, I grew up around farms, and I worked on farms, apple picking. And so I'm driving around yesterday out in, you know, west of Boston, and I'm noticing like signs for sweet corn, our sweet corn picked. Now my memory of corn is that it was an August thing, maybe into September. I don't remember being in October. You know, no, just as one little example,
sure.
Corn, yeah, corn on the cob being picked in October. I don't remember that. Maybe I'm wrong. But there's a lot of little stuff.
I think I spoke to one of Native Americans once,
yeah,
at the in Plymouth Rock. I think they do pick. It depends on
you
the,
eat it in October, definitely. But
oh,
you're eating,
oh, okay,
what you picked
pick,
in,
yeah,
you picked
it,
earlier.
It.
Maybe I'm wrong. That's my memory of it. Then also, well, also my where I live, my house, or the house the bank owns, actually. The lot of stuff's growing that I think would have been dead by now or dying by now. You know, certain bushes, leaves, lawn, grass, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I don't know. Multiply that times 100 if I was really out working in the ocean or something, and I'd really be noticing this stuff, or working in a field somewhere, I'd be like, this is serious,
well,
serious stuff.
I'm noticing migration of eagles.
What about it?
an eagle stopped by my my porch.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
nice. I'm looking at it like, yeah. Oh, my God, I wish I had a camera. Yeah, this is cool.
Yeah, they're coming back.
And he had a rat. He had a rat. I was like, yes.
That's what they're there for.
Yeah, owls. We need more, yes. You can come migrate over here.
Owls,
this is all the
owls
food
and
is
eagles,
at.
Man. They're like, they're the rodent control.
It was great. I was just looking at this thing like, really? He's got dinner right there. He's just looking at me. I'm looking at it, and I'm like, aren't you supposed to be up somewhere in Maine or White Mountains or something?
No, they're coming back. I've seen them. Yeah? I've seen them, yeah. Okay. I've seen, well, the other thing is like with, speaking of mice, something that people, a lot of people don't know. Did you ever see that? There was a Canadian writer who died in the last 10 years named Farley Mowat, kind of an interesting name, Mowat. And he wrote a lot of different stuff. And he was denied entry to the United States by the Reagan administration because he said...
Is he British?
No, he's Canadian. Oh, Canadian. He said that he was so sick of American planes flying over his land that he shot at one with like a 22 or something. And they took that seriously. I don't think he really did it. His metaphor, his hyperbole, really. But that was enough for Reagan to just deny him entry into the United States. And he, at the time, he was a fairly well-known author and stuff. They made a film out of his book, Never Cry Wolf, which is the point of this stupid digression, which is that... The Canadian
fairy tale of the kid.
No, not a fairy tale. This is real. This is very real. He was a biologist. His first job was the Canadian government. One of his first jobs sent him out to really wild, cold Alaska to study wolves because they wanted to kill them all. Basically, the Canadian government wanted to go out and poison them and shoot them and stuff because they thought they were limiting the caribou population. So he goes out there and he finds out a bunch of stuff just by, you know, empirical, scientific, you know, observation and recording and so on, that the wolves were mainly living off mice. That was their main food source. There were so many. And I used to hunt, so I can testify. You go up to certain parts of the mountains and based on certain local things that are happening, you can just have thousands of mice running around, you know. So the wolves were primarily living off of mice because they were plentiful at certain times of the year, and even in the really cold times, they could find some of them, dig them up, and stuff. And so he said, he wrote back saying, you know, don't kill the wolves, basically. Then he finds some hunters illegally hunting caribou, right? Then he sees the wolves when they were hunting caribou, sometimes, and he noticed they went after the sick ones. So they were playing a role of, you know, in terms of evolutionary terms, like making the herd more healthy. And they didn't take that much. They couldn't eat that much. And so all this came together to be the opposite picture of what the Canadian government said, you know. Now, whether that, I don't remember, I read the book, but whether that became a change in policy or they just buried that study, I don't know. I mean, I had a friend doing graduate student work on back when acid rain was identified as a big problem. It still is a problem, but it's just not talked about as much. And that's coal-burning power plants and the acidification of lakes and streams and so on through the particulates dropping into the lakes and streams. Yeah. And there's also mercury poisoning. He actually ended up, he's dead now, but he ended up doing a lot of advocacy against mercury poisoning. Not the stuff you hear on the radio. Make sure you take care of your thermometer. No, it's not about that. It's about coal burning. A byproduct of coal burning that they can't scrub away, by the way, is mercury. And that gets into everything. That's why it's unhealthy to eat even ocean fish now, because of all the coal burning power plants in the world. And I won't go into why that is, the science of it, but I'll just say, boom, it's coal burning. It is. Look it up. So
it goes into the cloud, it rains, goes right into...
It goes into the fish, right? It goes into the little fish. Which is not such a problem. You want to eat anchovies, it's not such a problem. But you want to eat krill, not such a problem. People don't usually eat krill, but anyway. But you eat, higher up the food chain of the fish, to the kind of fish people like to eat, the more mercury you have. It's a simple...
Like swordfish.
It's like swordfish. Simple. The bigger fish eat the littler fish, so more mercury gets concentrated in their bodies. Like tuna, Even salmon, I heard salmon for the first time linked to mercury poisoning. I've never read that. And I don't know if it was just they didn't want to ruin their money, you know, their the salmon industry and all the money they make, or if it was real science that somehow salmon is smaller and therefore not as much mercury concentration. I don't know the answer to that, but they're for the first time I saw it linked in a popular, you know, interpretation of science in some magazine or corporate media thing, saying that, oh yeah, salmon is affected by this mercury poisoning as well. But the point of these digressions are that, hey, even though it's becoming clear to everybody that climate change is deadly and really, really horrible, guess what? It's not going to be solved through capitalism or green capitalism or any of that crap they put forward or your consumer habits or any of that. That's not going to do anything. It's got to be socialism. And why does it have to be socialism? It's got to be an internationally planned economy where the planning is done based on sustainability and based on people's needs. So on the one hand, you get rid of the dichotomy that's often used by right-wingers and liberals even of the environment, jobs or the environment. Which do you want? Choose. Your living style or the environment. Choose. You know, people want jobs. They want decent living, you know. And under capitalism, well, you can't have those things, most of the people, really. You can't really have those things. But you can have that in a planned economy where you link sustainability and sustainable production with, on a mass scale, which would be have to be international, with, decent living standards, and jobs, and so on. And people control it directly through democratic planning and so on. And the, but the massive, the sort of material scientific reason for asserting that it can only be done under socialism is the massive nature of the problem. It goes way beyond borders, way beyond what any kind of incremental changes under capitalism can do. And the answer of, unfortunately, the liberals for the most part, and well, I'd say totally, and even some people that claim to be left-wing and others, is just saying to people, no, scarcity. You're gonna have to accept drastically lower living standards, which is real good news to people that already have drastically low living standards. you keep on the verge of starvation. You keep starving. We'll eat a little bit less, and everything will be fine. It's a lie. You can't do that to people. They won't accept it. And also, it's not that. It's not the choice. You could do that and still be having the horrible problems that you're having, because it depends on what kind of production you use. And the capitalists will defend polluting production as long as they can. Now, the counter argument would be, well, wait a minute. People can make money off of green technologies. Yeah, sure, they can. They can make money off it. They don't make as much money off it. Or they decide, okay, we'll make money off it later. Either of those answers is wrong, and we don't control what they do. We don't have democracy that goes into the corporate boardroom, and that's what socialism is all about. Socialism is all about the democratic, at root. It goes into all sorts of decision-making on all sorts of things, not just economic, but social things as well. But at root, it's about bringing democracy into the economy. That's what socialism is. So what's now the decisions of a tiny, tiny elite numerically, they're just tiny, they're insignificant statistically. They control our labor, they control the exploitation of nature, and they control the wealth that comes from exploiting our labor and nature, you know? Yeah. But getting into the main point here, I got this article I found called Just 100 Companies Will Sign Humanity's Death Warrant. The author is Lee Camp, and it came from, and again, I'm having this trouble, Truthdig. It came from Truthdig.
That's the Chris Hedges site?
I think so. Not sure, but I think it's the one he writes for. Only 100 companies, quote, will sign humanity's death sentence. That's it. 100 corporate boards filled with sociopaths. In recent weeks, climate activists in New York jammed up foot traffic on Wall Street with a die-in, covering themselves in fake blood and lying on the ground. Other activists in Washington, D.C., blocked intersections, etc. So he's actually defending these kinds of tactics. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Anyway, that's not the point I'm trying to get at from this article here. The corporations that are screwing up your life, tainting your water, polluting your air, buying up your favorite coffee shop and turning into a gas station, sucking your tax dollars up through subsidies, and all the while paying their employees a warm can of nothing per hour, almost nothing per hour. Those corporations are the same ones creating the climate catastrophe. In fact, The Guardian, that's a newspaper in England, reported that just 100 companies are responsible for 71%. This is the part I want to get to. Okay, 100 companies internationally are responsible for 71% of global greenhouse gas emissions. These include ExxonMobil, Saudi Aramco, Shell, Chinese and Russian coal companies, Chevron, BP, CNPC, which I have no idea what that is, ConocoPhillips, Gazprom, Lukoil, Total, or whatever they pronounce it, Petrobras, and many others, up to 100 they're talking about. 100 incredibly rich yet morally bankrupt companies. That is it. And it gets even worse. The Carbon Majors report revealed that more than half of all industrial emissions over the past 30 years were put out by just 25 corporate entities. Just 25. 25 companies are killing us, smothering us, stealing our futures while choking us, etc. So you get the point. It's a good article. I'm not going to go into the rest of it because it makes the point that, and I've read tons of similar articles. A lot of people will add the military, U.S. military. U.S. military is such a monstrous thing and it's extremely polluting that they'll say, it's corporate, big corporations and not even all that many. Not letting other ones off the hook, but saying, production's concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, like monopolization that Marx talks about, going back to Marxist, analysis of the economy and so on. The tendency towards concentration of capital, the tendency towards monopolization always works itself out sooner or later. Any kind of breakup of that through war or regulation for a time, it reasserts itself very quickly. And that's how capitalism works, right? You read Imperialism by Lenin, whatever, And so you have the situation where fewer and fewer corporations are actually responsible for more and more damage to the environment, to workers, to politics, if you want to look at that, the way they buy things. Like Bezos is now the richest person in the world, I believe, the Jeff Bezos who owns Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Notice I don't say runs Amazon. The corporate media, when they say somebody runs something, Bezos actually does very little work. One individual based on even planning, not even doing the work, leave that aside, which should be something people understand but really don't. Who does the work? But they brought the capital together. Well, the capital comes from previous work that wasn't fully paid for. All capital is the unpaid wages of previous workers. And so basically, you can claim that somebody brings the sort of pieces together, but they even hire people to do that kind of stuff. You have to understand, top corporate CEOs, they're hiring people to do a lot of the thinking, they just make the final decisions based on all sorts of people who they're exploiting, both mental labor and physical labor. If you ever hear someone say, like the corporate head of GM now, say that she runs GM, she's never built a car. She couldn't. It would take years for an individual to build a car, or a long time, right? I mean, it's just ridiculous to even think about. That's how we're trained to think, though. A corporate CEO builds cars. They don't. Even Ford admitted, I'm not in the business of building cars, which is wrong, that phrase. I'm in the business of making money, and that's what they're about, So anyways, the thing with someone like Bezos, who fights every bit of regulation, every bit of taxation, every bit of exploits horribly the Amazon workers. If I was reading an article about someone died in an Amazon plant and they forced everyone to go back to work the same day, they didn't say, okay, someone was killed here, let's, you can take the rest of the day off. They just forced them back to work. That's pretty darn Victorian of you, pretty darn early industrialism, but that stuff happens actually a lot. Someone died where I worked and they didn't stop the work, they didn't send everyone home.
In Harvard?
Yeah, mailroom guy died. Peter Cianciolo, he's a great guy.
Stroke or something?
Yeah, Peter Cianciolo was a great guy, great Harvard worker, union member in my union. He was in my area when I was a union representative. I represented him. He was a really nice guy. really nice guy, really friendly. Excuse me. And he was the mailroom guy for a big building that I work in, and part of the library system. Lots of books coming in and out, lots of other materials. They should have probably had two people. They used to have two people working that job. So he's working, works hard. One day, someone went in after a rush period and found him dead on the floor. And people thought at the time, including myself, we mostly thought about it like in personal terms, of course, how horrible it was. It was a big shock. But he might not, and he wasn't over that, you know, he's a little bit overweight, not really too much. There was a Coke near him. He had drank Coke right before he died.
Yeah.
So we were thinking of like, well, he must have been sick or something. But then the story kind of over time leaked out that they were working him hard, and he was really worried about getting more pressure from the bosses, the managers, about how much he was doing. So stress
will kill you.
But wait till you hear the second part. His brother had died recently. His brother was a food worker, like a chef, low level, you know, chef and so on, cook order. What do you call that? Order cook, line cook, that kind of thing, something like that.
Oh, where I work, it's either cook, first cook, second cook, you know, a cook.
What do you call them though? There's something like line sous cook.
Chef.
No, well, that's true too. Yeah,
line
you're right.
Cook. Yeah, you're right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So he did stuff like that, and he died young, ish, and so he left behind a lot of debts that for some reason Peter's family had to pay off. I don't know the details. And Peter's dad was retired. He's a laborer. He's in the laborers' union. Very pro-union guy. Very nice guy also. So Peter is like working a night job on top of the mailroom job. Basically wasn't sleeping. You know what I mean?
Lack of sleep.
People do that. Believe me, I used to do it. People do that. So it caught up to him. Lack of sleep. Not, you know, you have no time to exercise, of course. We've talked about that on the show before. I love it when, 'cause I'm overweight, and so the doctor's like, you got to exercise. I'm like, give me the money for the health club. Oh wait, and give me the time off, because through my job and commuting, I got no time to do that. You know, so we go back and forth. You know,
yeah, you give me a 25-hour week.
Yeah,
at the same pay that I'm making now,
I'll get in shape, man.
I'll be in shape.
I'll be like I was in my 30s.
I'll be Chuck Norris.
Yeah, Chuck Norris. I'll take on Chuck Norris. Did you hear about Chuck Norris?
No, he still looks the same.
No. Yeah, no. He stayed in shape for a long time. I don't know what he looks like now, but he stayed in shape for a long time.
Yeah.
Chuck Norris, for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with
Delta
him.
Delta Force.
He was a legitimate martial artist. He studied a type of Korean, similar to Taekwondo, but not Taekwondo.
Yeah.
Korean martial art, got really good at it. Knew Bruce Lee, was in Enter the Dragon. Him and Bruce Lee did a big thing.
What was it, that standoff between him and Bruce Lee?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so he used to do real like MMA type fighting before it was legal, before it existed. Like he would do tournaments where they allowed a certain amount of contact, but it was real contact, and they were pushing the boundaries because that was illegal in a lot of states. Like, it still is. Like, you can be charged with a felony if you kick someone with, you know,
what, a certified something black belt?
With a, no, that doesn't matter anymore. They used to. It's something like a blow with a shod foot. It's like when people stomp people, not to get gross, but when people stomp people or kick people, it's considered more serious.
So the police should be arrested for that. They stomp on people like there's no tomorrow.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Yeah. So anyway, the point is that Chuck Norris was a serious martial artist, but at a certain point, you know, he started doing movies. You mentioned one, right? Something called Delta Force or something?
Delta Force.
He did a funny movie called, they got the word octopus in it or something, or Octagon. Remember that? This was like early on his movie career. Well, there's a reason behind this. It was anti-Vietnam War.
They would talk about. Yeah.
He
did a right wing one.
He did a lot of. He became extremely right wing. No, he's still right wing.
Where he was a soldier who was like regretting the pullout of 75 from Vietnam. Remember?
Right.
The embassy,
right,
and
which
all
was
that.
Completely hypocritical on his part because he had done in 1969 or something like that or something. Or maybe it was 79 even. I don't know. But at some point it was called the Octagon. Look it up. It's anti-Vietnam War. Dabbles in conspiracy theory a little bit rather than getting at capitalism and all that. But But it's there, you know, it's there. It's on the record, man, that he made a lefty movie. It's sort of like Seagal made a pro-environmental movie one time. I don't know if you ever saw that one.
On Dangerous Grounds.
Yeah, something like that, where he does a speech about Native American rights and environmental rights and all this stuff.
Yes. I remember that one. I've actually seen that.
Yeah, someone like Chuck Norris, it's more understandable in a way because...
Well, what's his name? Mel Gibson with... what was that one where he was in Indonesia during the 60s?
Yeah. That was The Year of Living Dangerously.
Yes, that one. That was a good one.
That's a very good movie, but, you know, I loved that movie, and so I loved that movie so much, I started to study the director, Peter Weir. And the more I got into it, the more I was like, oh, no.
Why?
He's a right winger, basically. He wouldn't consider himself one. He would say he's a liberal or something. But he's really kind of very conservative. He made a very nasty kind of anti-Russian movie, just played into all the tropes, if that's the right word, or all the cliches about Stalinism and stuff. Anyway, he's the guy that made Witness, which I like, too, even though it's kind of hokey in some ways, but you know, this Harrison Ford thing.
Yeah.
So I like that. But anyway, so the point is that unfortunately this guy, and he didn't just turn, it was always in his works, I think. But You're Living Dangerously, a set and a take that nobody knows about, the 1965 mass genocide, basically mass murder of communists in Indonesia, or suspected communists, and also ethnic Chinese people, by a coup. Engineered by, what happened was, a coup, takeover by a Muslim right winger.
Yeah.
And
it's still that way.
They just went nuts. Oh, it's still horrible there.
I heard in Indonesia, you can walk around if you're not wearing, like, if the woman's not wearing that, what they call that robe or whatever, that.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
They get fined or they get lashed.
I don't know how strict, laws are interpreted that are related to Islam in Indonesia, because there are other religions in, like, in Bali, for example, and other places.
I think it depends
where you are. But what I do know about it is that in terms of, like, the left was just so terrorized by that mass massacre, it never still has not recovered, and it's really hard to talk about socialism or anything over there. That's sort of a left critique. It exists still, but it takes other forms. People are very underground with their ideas, unfortunately. So that, in a way, the mass genocide, totally supported and helped along by the Carter administration, by the way, the liberals.
Kissinger gave a green light.
Kissinger was totally involved. Nixon, Kissinger, then Carter.
East Timor, what was it, 75?
Yeah, East Timor East Timor kept... The people of East Timor kept fighting after that for independence, eventually gaining it, I think, legally, but they're still under the shadow of Indonesia. Right now in Papua New Guinea, massacres by the Indonesian government to try to stop separatist movement there. Which brings up a point, like part of the show today, I was going to say, you know, there's stuff happening all around the world that gets almost no mention in the media here. And when it does get mentioned, it's sort of like you get a clump of stories on the corporate media, then it's just dropped as if it's over. And it ain't over a lot of the time. So I've been looking at, and this is just...
That's like Barcelona today.
I was going to say that. Catalonia. Yep. The Spanish government is trying to put Catalonian... leaders of the Catalonian independence movement into jail for a long time, into prison for a long time. The people are revolting against that. People think Spain is this, like, some sort of democracy or something. When the Catalonian people actually
voted...
They
were fascist ever since 30-something.
Actually voted to go independent. They were suppressed militarily. They moved in the military to take over things like the post office.
And one thing that was...
Railroads and so on.
That was a good attribute of the Spanish Revolution... before Franco took over, was that Barcelona had their independence. That was part of the deal.
Yeah.
You know, and then Franco came in.
Yep.
Crushed that.
Crushed all the national...
And it's been like that since.
Because it's not so just it's Catalonia, it's Andalusia and other places that had the Basque
Galicia
country. Basque country. They all had their own identities that they wanted to promote. Now you're wondering...
But those are going
to
be, if it was still so, you know... socialists at the, mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. if they'd have won, that would have been recognized. You see what I mean?
Yep. Those yeah, no, I, it probably, yeah, most likely. I mean, Stalinism did not respect, for the most part, national, you know, self-determination movements. But before Stalinism, if you the Russian government in its early years after the revolution, and if you read the works of Lenin and other things, the right of nations to self-determination, meaning like mostly small countries fighting to get independence from out from under a big country, were very much respected by the socialist movement, by Marxists, and actually a lot of organizing happened that way. So for example, the Russian Revolution, you had all these countries that the Russian Empire, under the Tsar and then under new capitalism, was, you know, ruling over and suppressing with the Cossacks, very brutal suppression. The position of the Bolshevik Party into the revolution and afterwards was to give them their rights to independence. Not to give them, but actually help fight with them for independence. Now, that might sound weird because real good, real Marxists, real good socialists are internationalists. So why would you support a nationalist movement, as the corporate media would call it? Because think about it this way. What loyalty does a internationalist that's a leftist, that's a socialist, whatever, have towards the boundaries set up by capitalism, which are set up through brutal wars, genocide often, for money, you know, for territory, for markets, and for money, and for exploiting labor and exploiting natural resources. Boundaries are set up for the strongest in the capitalist, you know, melee, the capitalist wars and everything. So what if I'm living in Catalonia and I've got my, you know, generations going back fighting the fascists under Franco, fighting the Spanish government at other times, what loyalty do suddenly I have because it's been declared that this is that I live as I'm supposed to be Spanish and I still speak Catalan and whatever, you know? And so Lenin and others developed a whole theory around that where they would say, well, there's a problem with nationalist movements. Yeah, that oftentimes they're led by, say, under capitalism, capitalists, but they're just smaller capitalists or whatever, capitalists that want to base themselves in a new nation. And they even see that as a way to, like, carve out their own markets against imperialism or against the bigger nation they're fighting. And that's not good, right? But underneath that are millions of people sometimes often more or less, who are fighting for things that they consider their rights, including better economic conditions for themselves, better working conditions, you know, higher minimum wage, whatever. And those are very progressive. So if you're a socialist organizing in that area, you're going to organize for progressive things like that, even if they're directed at the, or especially if they are directed at the national bourgeois or the imperialist bourgeois, the imperialist ruling elite or the national ruling elite. And so one of the best things to read, if you're really into reading, if you want to get into reading about Marxism for real and not just what the slanders you hear about it, is Lenin's essays on the right of nations to self-determination and other people that support that, those ideas. And that's one reason the Russian Revolution succeeded, because they could have, the capitalists in Russia could have easily divided up the movement along national lines, the socialist movement that was successful in overthrowing capitalism in 1917 in Russia. They could have easily divided up on national lines, but the Bolsheviks were so skillful as organizers, going and saying, yes, we support your national aspirations. And they did. And then they fought alongside them. And then after the revolution, they were independent nations. When the Stalinists came in, that changed. The Stalinists came in, They went backwards. Yeah, they went back to the old czarist regime of divide and rule.
They went into socialism in one country, not the... Not the Trotsky.
And also, if a country... Yeah, yeah. And also, the propaganda against the Russian Revolution is that they forced countries to support them. No, they got their support voluntarily, and ones that didn't want to support them, they were independent. They weren't part of the early Russian Revolution. They weren't considered part of it, like, you know, Latvia and all those other countries like that ended up fighting Stalinism. But anyway, the point is that to understand what the difference between socialism, real socialism, revolutionary socialism, and liberalism, there's a whole range of ways of looking at things and ways of organizing that that identify that as not liberal and not conservative, but something else, you know, entirely, which is foreign, is just not even thought of in because of the role of the corporate media and educational system here. So I was on my way here hearing about Brexit, right? There's tons of corporate media stuff about Brexit. And it's all from the standpoint of more or less, that's ridiculous. Why would you want to leave the European Union? Well, guess why? The European Union is run by the European Central Bank. And every time something happens in your country, if you're part of the European Union, your national government can be overruled by the European Central Bank, or can be severely influenced or dominated by the European Central Bank. So privatization of social services, cutting countrywide minimum wages, breaking strikes and unions, deregulation for big corporations. European Central Bank puts forward capitalist policies, and then that dominates the local economies. What socialist in their right mind, what Marxist, communist, whatever, leftist in their right mind would support that? And yet, there's a section of the left that supports that because the propaganda is so huge that they reframe it as, oh, don't you want to go to another country and work? Don't you want to be able to do that? Well, guess what? You could do that before, maybe not as easily, but you could do that before the Eurozone. And you could still have, you could still create, you know, agreements of mutual, you know, working, being able to work in other countries without the economic component, you know, of austerity.
Before 96, it before 96 when there wasn't a European Union?
Exactly.
So it was just being thought of or whatever or formulated. Right. And then all of a sudden, right, there you go, Europe.
Right.
You're one now.
Yeah.
Here's one currency.
Yep. How it was.
So it's everything out of whack.
For working people, how it was a lot better.
I went to the Azores. Yeah.
Well, in some countries, but not always.
I went there because my girlfriend at the time was from Azorean.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was telling me that this took us from, you know, having the escudos, all of a sudden we have to deal with this, and it was a big confusion.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't easy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Actually, one of the things I want to talk about that, we can maybe slide from that into your, talk about your trip a little bit, is that the, on this show, we've talked a lot about the Yellow Vest movement in France, which is pretty much over as far as I can tell. And that was also spit on by liberals.
Wow, they've been at it for a year, huh?
Well, it was longer than that, but it's pretty much over as far as I can tell. But let me just finish the thought real quick. It's the same kind of thing. Like, a real socialist should not be for continued dominance of the European Central Bank over people. And therefore, you're not what's the opposite of Brexit? Because I'm so used to saying Brexit, I don't know what the opposite is. You know, you're not anti-Brexit. I hate to use two negative sort of. You're not anti-Brexit. I'm sorry. You're pro-Brexit if you really care about working people and the environment. You should be pro-Brexit because the European Central Bank is against those two things, and hugely so. And the European Parliament is weak and ineffectual because there are rules that, and also money buys it off, just like any other democracy under capitalism, but there are rules that limit its effectiveness. In other words, there are supra-legislative bodies, just like with NAFTA, that actually rule the enforcement of a lot of that stuff. So, point is, if you're a real socialist or any worker that's class conscious or influenced by real revolutionary socialism, or whatever, you would be for breaking the treaty, the Eurozone treaties. That this would not be something you would defend. And yet, in the context of Britain and other countries, you have some left groups, not all, but you have some left groups supporting the European Central Bank, effectively supporting the Eurozone. And the propaganda has been so intense from sections of the bourgeois that make a lot of money, sections of the capitalist class make a lot of money from privatization, austerity, deregulation, all the stuff the European Central Bank loves so much, that it's just sort of like among liberals and, you know, trendy, you know, hipster types. So, of course, we love the Eurozone. It's just great. I can go have coffee in Paris tomorrow or something. Well, you could do that in the 90s too, by the way, you idiot. But
I know.
But whatever. It's really just another example of many of where I think a lot of people would conflate liberal and left real left, real revolutionary socialist ideas together, and they're very, very different. They're very, very different in a lot, in many, many, most examples you can think of. And it's the same. And the reason I thought of that is because of the environment discussion we were having a minute ago. You know, there's so much liberal propaganda out there that says you can solve the environmental crisis under capitalism. Of course, there's tons of conservative propaganda out there about that too, or denying that the crisis exists at all.
And they're in the conservative side. You know what they're saying?
It doesn't exist. No problem.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah. It's all conspiracy.
They just want to extract more money.
Right. But so are the liberals. They want to extract more money from either downplaying the crisis or giving lip service to the crisis, but keeping the institutions in power that create the crisis. That's what we're trying to say as non-liberals and non-conservatives, as real leftists, that, wait a minute, the solution and the problem itself is embedded in the economics of capitalism. And you're not going to overcome that without destroying capitalism and creating a new type of economic system, one based on international democratic planning of the people that actually do the work, and one that wants to do this production that is needed to have everyone in the planet to have a decent life in a sustainable way. And it can be very sustainable. You know, you have the situation even under capitalism. This is a thing that Marx and other Marxists, early Marxists, talked about and still talk about today. If you read eco-socialists like John Bellamy Foster or others, they say, look, technology already exists under capitalism to do a lot of the things that could be sustainable. It's often like messed up, you know, but it's there. So I use this example I found out recently when I'm talking to people about this sort of thing. And I'll do it again because it was fun in my head. Name the second biggest food exporter in the world right now. By
me?
Country. I'm asking you. Ask.
A country or a company?
A country.
Second. Mexico.
No, good guess. But absolutely wrong. You're gonna be shocked. Keep going.
US.
Keep guessing. Wrong. Keep guessing. Number one, I believe, is China or the US. I'd have to double check on that, but
Hold on. Yeah, Africa. Yeah.
Nope. Africa is a continent, but go ahead. Say a country in Africa, any country in Africa, go ahead. Because there's a big country, right? Nigeria is huge. South Africa, huge. No.
So it is in Africa.
No, not Africa at all. No. It's the Netherlands. It's little tiny Dutch land.
Are you serious?
Holland is the second biggest food exporter in the world. Why? Because they concentrated a lot of government subsidies and capital investment into... Greenhouse production, high tech greenhouse production of food.
Now I heard, are they growing bananas in greenhouses?
I don't know about bananas, but they're growing a lot of stuff in greenhouses, and they have also basic agriculture in their tiny country.
You know,
that's not greenhouse related.
Greenland or Iceland have?
Iceland also has a lot of greenhouse production.
They're growing bananas.
Yes, Iceland has a lot of greenhouse production.
So I was like, in Portugal, this is from. I was like, what? You got a banana from where? How do they grow it? It's not even tropical.
Hey, Iceland has
You would think Africa or somewhere, you know, because it's closest to Portugal,
right?
I'm like, nah.
Yeah, Iceland has no mosquitoes.
Really?
And it has thermal energy. So it's... volcanic thermal energy, which they use a lot. I'm not saying it's paradise or anything, because they still have polluting stuff in Iceland, and the place is practically without trees, because they did and still do a lot of sheep farming there, which just they cut down trees so sheep can eat grass, and it's just a horrible... And then that leads to harsher climate conditions.
Just like what was happening in Brazil.
Happened in Scotland and other places.
In Brazil.
Like, yeah, there's,
that was
there's
a setup.
Early,
They're burning
yeah,
stuff
yeah,
to have
that's
more
a great,
cattle.
That's a great example.
More cattle. Yeah. We got to destroy the Amazon for more cattle.
So if you want to look at the capitalism from its destruction of the environment as part and parcel of the development of capitalism... The burning of the Brazilian rainforest that people are finally starting to understand.
We even had smoke coming into Mexico.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The
that's
weather
horrible.
Patterns were being affected because of this.
Yeah. Well, all I was going to say was that there was a lot of Brazilian rainforests examples, things like that in the history of capitalism. Tons of them. And that's horrible. I'm just saying that. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. The Brazilian rainforest is not this unique crime against humanity. It is a crime against humanity, but it's unfortunately not unique in terms of environmental destruction. Iceland itself, as an example, had its own environmental destruction based on early capitalism, as did places like Scotland and others. You can go through any country in the world. The United States, of course. I mean,
Haiti's another one.
Haiti, horribly destroyed. Yeah. You know what? Have you been to the Dominican Republic? You've been there, right?
I've been there once. My sister actually lives there.
Yeah. So does it look different than Haiti? Is there more trees and stuff?
There's more trees in Haiti.
Because I read somewhere like half.
Well,
country.
You know what happened in Haiti was that, and I was told by a Dominican guy at work. He's like, "Well, the thing with Haiti is that they started cutting the trees and selling it to places like China or Japan because their woods are so valuable."
Right. Right.
You know, and that messed up the whole. You know.
Yeah. But my whole point is like the Dominican half of the island, so to speak, has more trees because they didn't do the same stuff.
You got more land.
I'm not saying it's better under capitalism. I'm just saying it's different. It's the exploitation of nature happened differently. But
we're in Dominican Republic, more of a cattle society.
Yeah,
you know, it's a sugarcane society.
Yeah. By the way, though,
during the slavery.
Yep. You're right. That's one thing. Yeah.
Then obviously, the French got kicked out. So, you know, and then the whole fear of, oh my God, this is going to spread.
Wish it had.
Africanism is going to spread.
Wish it had.
Like Black Jacobins. You read that book, right?
By C.L.R. James. Our readers should definitely read Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James.
And of course, the United States. You know, and it's still, look at now what's happening. There's a civil war happening now against the government over there.
Well, that's what I was going to say. With those protests we were starting to list earlier, you got Haiti. You have, what is the one you mentioned? Ecuador?
Ecuador won.
You have the Hong Kong. Hong Kong, Haiti, Ecuador,
Chile,
Lebanon is exploding
Chile
now
because of something that we should be already on it. The tea fair hike.
They had a similar. Yeah.
That sparked it, but of course there was other underlying things already. You know.
Yeah.
But that hit the nail. That's like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Where here we just go, okay, it is what it is. I'm going to be a bootlicker.
Yeah, Americans have a reputation of being bootlickers of capitalism, unfortunately, and unfortunately it's well-deserved. Not totally, because right now, even as we speak, we have huge strikes happening in the U.S. Very proud of our brothers and sisters.
You saying that we have more strikes now than we did in 86, right?
In 2018, Bureau of Labor Statistics, part of the government, admitted there were more strikes of 1,000 or more workers, or 500 or more, 1,000 or more workers, than at any time since 1986. And that is an important statistic, because in 86, there was still a much larger labor movement in the United States than there is now, and a more militant one, even under Reagan. Reagan is blamed or credited, if you're a reactionary, with chilling out the labor movement and hurting the labor movement in the United States and basically starting to destroy it. That's true to a certain extent, but what a lot of people don't know is that Reagan was carrying through policies that were started earlier, actually under the Carter and Ford administrations, and policies that were engineered from, you know, the Wall Street, basically. But, you know, they got to in the early 70s, the big institutions, the big sort of think tanks of big business in the United States got together and said, wait a minute, we're just not making the profits that we need to be making. We foresee a decline in profits from because they'd made huge profits from about 1950 to 73. I mean, massive, biggest profits ever in the United States, the post-war upswing, as it's called. But they were recognizing from their point of view, the limitations of that. They wanted even more profits. Under capitalism, people are like, you know, people, and I understand this, but it's just not scientific, but I understand the emotion. I feel it myself. When is it enough for these people? When does Jeff Bezos say, I've earned enough money? When does Bill Gates say, I've earned enough money? When do these people stop? Why don't they stop? They never do until they die or something. Or if you want to show me a capitalist that bailed out and go lived on an island somewhere, okay, you can show me a few examples. But mostly you've got these corporate boards of incredibly rich people that could retire yesterday forever. They'll have more money than I'll ever see in my life or even understand, really, mathematically, what you could buy with that money. They keep making more and more money. And their corporations, they do things that make their corporations that they control make more and more money to no limit. There's always no limit, you know? Today, the top corporate earner controls 30, I'm just throwing out a number, it could be a lot more than this, 30 trillion in assets or something. But tomorrow they want 50 trillion in assets. Why is that? Is it just human greed? I saw this film yesterday on Netflix called The Laundromat by Soderbergh. Steven Soderbergh, is that his name? He's a director. He's done some...
So the guy that did Che?
Yes, he did Che. Before that, he did King of the Hill, which is a really interesting movie politically. You never heard of it, but it was
not
a great
King
movie.
Not King of the Hill, the cartoon.
He did Sex... No, he did Sex, Lies, and Videotape, okay. Which everyone put him on the map. That's kind of a rotten movie. I don't really like it. Then he did his first follow-up movie after being a successful Hollywood director, back when that mattered more than it does now. He did a movie called King of the Hill, I believe is the title of it, based on a Hoechner, H-O-E-C-H-N-E-R, novel. And it's a brilliant film, terribly overlooked film, absolutely brilliant. Soderbergh is a good director, but this movie, The Laundromat, is politically confused and just completely lightweight. It's based on the Panama Papers revelations about, fake companies, shell holding companies, they call them, and the corruption and all that kind of stuff. Doesn't even touch at the heart of capitalism. Doesn't even get at the mechanisms. There's no heart of capitalism. Doesn't get to the, machinery of capitalism at all. It's sort of like very emotive on a very just kind of a liberal level. There's some interesting parts of it, but it's really not that great. But the reason I'm mentioning is that I forgot what the tie-in was, but it doesn't get to the heart of the matter. Any case, I lost my train of thought there. Sorry, but I can bring it back to the beginning, which is the yellow vests. Now, here's an interesting article from Bloomberg, which is not a left-wing news source by any means. And Bloomberg says the following, and I tried to say this on the show here. French yellow vest protesters were right about rising inequality. Like Brexit, the overwhelming media portrayal of the yellow vest movement, the corporate media especially, was dismissive, derogatory, and outright, throw them all in prison type coverage, And also in France, you had left-wing groups and some unions, et cetera, that should have supported them. Some did, but some didn't. And that just blows my mind. Like, why is your loyalty to the French state or something? Why is your loyalty to the banking system? I mean, what these people are out protesting, mostly on economic terms. But because they were populated a lot by people that weren't normally protesting, and because it was not led by the usual suspects, the unions, and I mean that in a good sense. I mean, I shouldn't use that bad term. It wasn't led by some good union leaders or some left-wing parties there. There was a lot of suspicion, and that, it was infiltrated by the right and all that sort of thing. And it really wasn't, actually. People went into the movement and said, do I hear any right-wing stuff? Almost none, you could hear stuff here, anti-immigrant stuff here, if you go out amongst vast numbers of, like, if all of a sudden, like with the Yellow Vest movement, if all of a sudden 100,000 people start hitting the streets in say New York in a protest, if you sit down with coffee with each person in that protest, some of them are going to have bad ideas. Some are going to be like, I'm sick of all these immigrants or something, but I'm out here protesting because I can't make a living. So our response is, as socialists, say, well, wait a minute, that's not the immigrants that make it, you can't make a living. That's, it's like capitalism.
That, remember that May Day that you in 2010 out in the Commons?
Yeah.
And we had the banner, and the guy's like, go, get out of my country, you're not American. So I'm like, yeah, you don't look American yourself.
There's a lot of that. There's immigrants, there's second or third generation immigrants that are anti-immigrants.
What
pretty
was that,
fast.
1070, the act that they were going to pass?
Yeah. And that was that 2010 or earlier?
That was 2010.
Because we won that.
I'll never forget that.
We won that, though. That was a victory.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good movement.
I'll never forget
that.
That was a really good movement.
It didn't last, though. That's the problem.
The guy was drunk. He was just like, go back to that.
Yeah. See, my thing with, I just gave a little thing here as we're talking about how if you sit down with a person over coffee, convince them it's not immigrants that's your enemy, it's the capitalists and all that kind of stuff. That sounds all very nice. But when I'm in the street and someone starts yelling at me, I don't do that. I'm like, fuck. I'm like, no, go away. we're protesting here. If you don't get it later, because there's always a lot of people that are really curious, when you're out protesting. There's always a certain number of people that are curious, and that's great. But one loud fascist or drunk guy can just make it turn chaos, turn the thing into chaos, And I don't stand for that. I'm like, no, you have your day. You go have your protest. Somewhere else.
40 ounce, please.
Yeah. Enjoy. Actually, it. If it's a fascist, I don't agree they have a right to protest anywhere Yeah, remember the 2 years ago? Did you go to that?
Yes, but I was with one of my friends. A lot of my friends out in Roxbury.
Do you remember that?
As soon as we got there in that
little group wanted to protest.
Yeah, yeah.
The fascist group, the right wingers.
As soon as they seen the wave right-wingers. Of people coming from Tremont and Roxbury line, they were like, I think we should go now. I think we should get out.
Yeah. So
they got scared. They got nervous. Yeah. Like
anyone that wasn't there.
Well, you said a total story about the 80s.
Yeah, no, I'll tell that one in a second. Yeah. Well, let me do this one first. So you had what? You had a bunch of groups that were severely fascist, but some of them trying to hide and say they weren't really.
We were just Trump supporters that could make America great.
They weren't. I'm not equating Trump and Trump supporters with fascism. There might be some overlap, obviously, but there isn't. I'm not saying Trump's a fascist. He might want to be. He might be moving in that direction, but he's not a fascist. So, the reason I make that distinction is because I believe, and I think most good socialists or revolutionary socialists would believe, that there can be no public platform for fascists. You can't say a fascist group has a right to do their thing in a public street. You can't give up that street to the fascists. That's why Nazism won. One reason Nazism won in Germany is that people allowed them to function normally.
In the political system.
The Communist Party allowed them to function, or the state, of course, allowed them to function, because they kind of liked them. And that's not acceptable, because fascism is about murder, and one of the first people they're going to come after is people like us. I mean, they're going to come after socialists and Marxists.
Their opponents.
And the unions and so on, their opponents first, and then they're going to pick out a group of people, like the Jews in Germany or wherever, or in the current context. Probably some sort of race war or something, you know, they would want to start. And that's unacceptable. You can't go out and argue for murder and genocide of people in public. That's why I quit the ACLU. I was in the ACLU for a few years, you know.
What is that? Thanks.
American Civil Liberties Union. Mm-hmm. Went back when I was in college, and I sort of got to know some of their lawyers and stuff when I was a paralegal. And I could have worked for them or whatever, but I'm like, wait a minute. There was this thing called Skokie. Remember that? Skokie, Illinois. Mm-hmm. This is actually before, I think, this period where I knew some ACLU lawyers in Boston. I was getting into that a little bit, but it was always bothered me in the back of my mind. But I don't remember the exact date. I'll go look it up for next time. But Skokie, Illinois, there was this thing where the courts ruled the Nazis could march on the public street. The ACLU supported them. Out of an abstract, we support the right to free speech. Now, why do I say abstract ACLU? Because on the one hand, speech is not free under capitalist society. It's the people with money that buy it and control it. Look who controls the airwaves, for example. This station has, you know, minimal signal power and minimal presence on the internet, but the big corporate media giants have enormous money.
All the way to Mars.
Airwaves, but also on the internet, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not new under capitalism. They own the newspapers, they own so on. That means there's really not, you pay a lot for speech in this country. It's not free at all. But also from the standpoint of government suppression and censorship and so on, which the ACLU would agree with a lot of that. But they want to extend their abstract notion of free speech to Nazis and say, well, yeah, they're this political group that wants to go out and say a few things. No, that's the equivalent of saying they do support the KKK as well. I think it was Skokie was the KKK, I think.
Yeah.
Now think about all the stuff that's coming out because of a lot of good work of research and promotion of the horrible history of slavery in this country, including lynchings under Jim Crow, including Jim Crow, and all that. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, just the surface is being touched. They're not linking the Democratic Party yet. They're not linking it to other institutions in America that made their money. I mean, Bank of Boston, which is now, which bank is Bank of America or something? That was started from slave money. You know, let's talk about reparations. Let's take that bank under public ownership, and you got enough money for reparations for everyone. You know, Native Americans and, of course, descendants of slaves and so on. So anyway, the point is that
As you know, Bank of America is Italian originally.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
That's what I heard.
No, I don't think so. No? I think you heard wrong.
I might have heard wrong.
I might have heard wrong, too. My understanding is Bank of Boston, which existed for a long time, which made a lot of its money, I mean, really its initial capital off of the slave trade, even though it was based up here, because you had the rich Eastern banks making money off that. It went among the, as well as the slave owners, of course. That has been taken over. Well, maybe it did come from an Italian. I don't know. I have to study that more. Anyway, lost my train of thought on that, too. We got to give the legal ID, though. Yep. This is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. And less formally known as Tufts Educational Radio sometimes, otherwise known also as Tufts Freeform Radio.
Well, like just to remind you, what we were talking about was you were about to tell the story of the 80s when the KKK came out here.
First, I